This is Chuck DeVore, and you're listening to the Texas Tribune Tribcast. As a former California lawmaker and political refugee, I'm urging Texans to get serious about border security. Unless Texas builds a wall on its western border, it stands to be overrun by millions of Californians looking for work and handouts.
Thank you. This is Evan Smith, editor-in-chief and CEO of the Tribune, substituting this week for Reeve Hamilton here on the Tribcast.
This is already funny.
How that I can possibly ever fill Reeve's Pumas or whatever it is that he wears around the office. Reeve is off reporting a story today, so I've drawn the black bean and I get to host this week's Tribcast, and I'm pleased to be joined by Ross Ramsey, our executive editor.
Howdy.
And reporters Morgan Smith.
Hello.
And Julian Aguilar.
Hello.
Nice to have you all here. We'll have some fun. We're going to mess things up and leave the wreckage for Reeve when he comes back. That's how I hope we go through this thing. We have a lot to talk about this week. We're beginning to get into the meaty part of the legislative session, even though we're still technically within the first 60 days and there's not supposed to be any serious business transacted. The reality is there's a lot going on up the street. And beginning with education, Morgan, we knew that education was going to be agenda item number one this session with discussions of choice and accountability in student testing. And in fact, just over the last couple of days, we've had a couple of big hearings and a lot of discussion of where these issues are likely to end up.
Yeah, we have. We've had major omnibus legislation filed by both Jimmy Don Acock, who chairs the House committee, and Senator Dan Patrick, who leads the committee in the Senate. And we've had hearings on assessment, which is where a lot of the momentum is for reform this session. Parents and educators feel that the pendulum has kind of swung too far in it towards high-stakes testing, and that needs to be scaled back this session. We've also seen movement from industry groups who are pushing to change graduation requirements to allow more flexibility for students to take career and technology courses. And then we've seen some pushback from higher education people who say that this is rigor that we have worked towards for a long time, and if we kind of change that up, that we're going to start to see less skilled people, more students in remediation once they get to higher ed.
And these are not partisan issues. You know, you might expect a lot of issues, given the nature of politics in Texas today, to break down along pretty clear party lines, but both choice and testing are not issues where Democrats are on one side and Republicans are on the other.
And that's right. Yesterday or Tuesday at a hearing in the Senate, you saw Wendy Davis sitting up there criticizing the testing system. You saw Dan Patrick sitting up there. You saw Robert Duncan. You saw Kel Seliger. So you saw, you know, the urban side, the rural side. You saw Republican and Democrat all sitting up there saying that that we've gone too far with testing in the state. And the other interesting thing about it is that, you know, this is something that passed with overwhelming support. This regimen that everybody is currently criticizing.
Back when it was accountability, right?
Back when it was accountability. And in 2009, it was something, you know, Dan Patrick sat on the conference committee that, you know, hammered out the final language of what this assessment system was going to look like, how we were going to implement it as a state. And we've really come all the way back around in from the other direction. And in fact, there was even efforts last session from the House to make some of the changes that now everyone is pushing for this session, but it was blocked in the Senate. So it's really interesting to see how just the political climate has changed on this issue and how just how unanimous the sentiment is now against high-stakes tests.
Well, to the point of unanimous, Morgan, and I'll open it up to the rest of you, who at this point is for testing
other than
Pearson lobbyists?
Well, Bill Hammond is, you know, for it, you know, flying a plane over the Capitol,
right.
And, you know, that said, is 37% passing rate too hard for algebra?
There's nothing I like more than a Texas Association of Business stunt, right?
They're quite good.
I'm glad to know that we have time for stunts.
Among the electeds, though, who is defending these tests?
It's kind of a hot potato right now. There's not a lawmaker out there that really wants to touch it and say, hey, you know, let's make sure that we don't go too far in this other direction. And you see folks in the in the business community is divided on this, but you do still see folks like Bill Hammond, other Chamber of Commerce people getting up there and saying, you know, there's a reason that we moved to this system in the first place. there's still a lot of work to be done. We need to make sure that, you know, there's proper checks in place to make sure students are learning. But, I mean, there's not really lawmakers out there who are going to sit there and stand up and say, hey, let's not do this way, because I think it's something that was hammered home for all of them during the recent election season from parents, from educators, and from people that they listen to. So
it was right. Pretty clear during the election season that, you know, we would ask them, you know, are you hearing a lot about education? And kind of half expecting, because we'd covered the last session, to hear something about, yeah, those cuts that they made in the budget or those teachers they fired or something like that. And
but
it
no,
came back
it's,
almost
it's
100%.
This.
You know, those STAR tests have got to go.
I think the last count, there were 92% or 93% of school boards in the state representing more than 95% or 96% of students had all passed resolutions against the current testing regime. So these legislators at least understand that their folks back home don't like this stuff.
Yeah, they do.
Right? And they're responsive as far as it goes when their voters tell them, we don't like this.
They worry
about their own security, job security.
This is how it's supposed to work, right?
Right. And I think, you know, to the extent that there is any kind of pushback, you might see lawmakers beginning to say things like, well, you know, I think we can all agree that we've gone too far with high stakes testing, but let's not get too carried away and think that we need to make all these drastic changes to the requirements the courses that students have to take in order to graduate from high school, or that we need to completely redo the different standards that schools have to meet in our accountability system to go along with all of that.
There's no danger, Morgan, that they're going to go too far in the other direction. The pendulum having swung so far on one side, the tendency is to overcorrect.
Right.
Even well-meaning people overcorrect. And so we've got 15 exams or whatever it is. Now we're going to go, okay, get rid of all of them. But then it's going to be
essentially 5 exams, right, is what they're talking about
five
in Hancock's bill, right?
Yes, 5 is
that would be as far as the pendulum swings back.
That is. I mean, and they're hindered in some way by No Child Left Behind, which does require testing. So there was, you know, proposals during the last session that towards the end where, you know, the House actually passed a bill out that had an amendment on it that did away with all testing altogether. And that's illegal under federal law. So there is kind of, they can only go so far. And I think that there's some testimony in the hearings from educators saying that, you know, we'd really actually only like to see 3 tests, but, you know, we'll take 5 because we think that that's a good compromise.
So this is a little bit random, but, you know, Dietz in the school finance ruling, John Dietz, the Travis County judge who heard the first level case, said in a bench ruling that, you know, part of the problem here is that if you are going to maintain the standards that you have set, then you're not putting enough resources into schools. Does this move us toward lowering those standards? Or are they, I mean, what's the dance on that?
I mean, I think that's the argument that you do hear from people like Bill Hammond and others in the business community saying that, you know, they equate reducing the number of tests with reducing standards. And I think that is very much an argument. But as far as it goes towards kind of the funding and all of that and kind of the points that Judge Dietz was making in the lawsuit, I think that, I mean, the very kind of simple response that people in the education community come back with is say that, no, this is about giving us more time, more ability to provide high-quality education to meet those standards. The tests are just kind of draining that out of the system as it is right now.
Hmm. And let me ask you just quickly on choice where we stand on this. We know that Senator Patrick has intentions of launching some big move toward choice, but it's unclear whether in the end his legislation will simply be open enrollment within public school districts or will allow tax dollars to migrate out to parochial and private schools without the accountability that
the artist formerly known as vouchers, right?
Right.
That's right.
We don't say the V word around here. That's it. My sense from what Chairman Aycock on the House side has proposed as part of his omnibus bill, it doesn't seem to be a migration of tax dollars out to parochials and privates, at least for now, being discussed openly on the House side.
No, I think that there are people out there that are scratching their heads a little bit saying, you know, why haven't we seen this big bill from Senator Patrick, you know, the one that he has spent you know, months before the legislative session even began, kind of beating the drum for. And then I think another kind of signal that, you know, might not end up being quite the big bill that everyone is waiting for is that he came out with his a big charter school bill this week, and it had it's SB2, which I think a lot of people questioned. You know, SB2 is kind of, that's a high bill number. Why? That's something that, you know,
sort of implies support from Dewhurst and
right, exactly.
Right.
And
right. Symbolism matters.
Right.
And it's but instead it's this charter school bill that people kind of thought, while reform, people who want school choice reform think those issues are important, it's definitely not kind of the biggest issue on the agenda, which for people that want to be able to open up the public school system.
But isn't there one way to read this, which is that if we're going to have a bill that essentially does away with most testing, and we think that there's opposition to moving tax dollars into the parochial and private schools, that maybe what Dan Patrick may be doing here is trying to get as much as he can under the circumstances and saying, well, if we can't expand choice into the parochial and private schools, at least let's blow the lid off the cap on charters so that we have much more, quote, choice within the public realm.
Well, they've also talked about choice as you know, independent of anything that used to be called vouchers. You know, so all of the things, you know, you kind of referred to it a minute ago, the whole bit about being able to move from the school you're in to another school in that school district, or even from the school you're in to an adjacent school district somewhere else, all yep. of that sort of under the umbrella of choice now. And, you know, one of the problems that some of the people who wanted vouchers historically have run into is that vouchers is a really dirty word with voters right now. It doesn't yep. poll very well. It's just, it's bad
and
juju.
Again, to the point we made earlier, Morgan, it's also bipartisan in that the support for vouchers may not be very large. The opposition is large, and the opposition is itself bipartisan. There are Democrats and Republicans who both oppose this.
Yeah, there's always been rural opposition from Democrats and Republicans,
yeah.
right? Because you're messing with a community institution in little towns, right? The public school, right? The gym, the football team, all of that kind of stuff. I think they'll probably, you know, I mean, it looks like they could easily put together a school choice bill that doesn't have anything that looks like vouchers, although they've talked about the scholarship program.
Yeah, the scholarship program. And I should mention also that in this week, during the hearing on assessment, that Dan Patrick he dropped a hint that, you know, he was going to have another big bill coming, and so there's kind of that to keep our eyes open for. But I mean, yes, he did. He and Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst had a press conference at the end of last year where they laid out a program for school choice that they
tellingly
said
they had it at a parochial school.
They had it at a parochial school, and they said that they wanted to create a scholarship program where basically businesses could get tax credits that would for donating to this scholarship program, and it would allow students to attend schools of their choice, including in the private sector. So it's, I mean, while, you know, we might see kind of as a compromise a move towards choice within the public school system, opening up the charter school, the charter schools for more expansion, you know, it's not as if we never were talking about having, you know, a broader vision of what we needed to do for school choice. So,
yeah. Both testing and choice are going to be huge issues going forward. And Julian, immigration is emerging as a very close second to education. Both nationally and in Texas, the conversation has really turned in earnest to what comprehensive reform looks like. Not whether we're going to have it, but given the fact that we're going to have it, what's it going to look like?
And they're not talking about anything they were talking about 2 years ago, are they?
No, I was going to start off saying that. I mean, I think everybody in the State House is, I guess, pleased that the conversation that, you know, conversations were around 2 years ago don't exist today. But something interesting happened last week when Representatives Anchia and Hernandez Luna co-authored this resolution in support of comprehensive immigration reform. And Representative Anchia was very deliberate. He said, look, I know resolutions are, you know, just usually symbolic. I want this to have some teeth. So they crafted it in the way that drew a lot of language from statements Republicans have made in favor of this. So, you know, we wrote that it's going to be a litmus test to see, you know, who was on board. It was crafted as this everybody come together sort of kumbaya moment. You know, fast forward a week after he filed it, I asked the representative yesterday, I was like, so how's it going? How are you shopping your resolution? He's like, it's great. Every Democrat signed on to it. And that's where it stopped. So I said, okay, well, you know, I thought that this was going to be something that the Republicans could, you know, support. What's happening now is that there's divisions within the Republican Party on a guest worker, support for a guest worker program, support for path to not even citizenship but to legal status, which is where I think the gridlock is at the state level. You have some folks that are, you know, say that, you know, we're given a free pass. The, you know, if vouchers is a bad word for, you know, school, for the education system, then amnesty is as toxic on immigration.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to stay away from that. Excuse me, the Republicans want to stay away from that. And then what's happening at the same time is that you get a lot of different groups. You know, you get the Grover Norquist that were here, you know, he was here last week. You get Todd Staples, you know, and Commissioner Patterson to a certain extent championing their own sort of ideas of what can happen. But then
you had George P. Bush and Addison last week saying that the Republican Party shouldn't sell out on immigration. Grover Norquist came to Austin and talked about a center-right solution.
Yeah.
George P. Bush talked about not selling out. That seems to be completely in opposition to the idea that maybe the party is going to move to the middle on this at the national level.
Yeah, and I think that's surprising a lot of folks. I think everybody thought, okay, well, let's get this out of the way. And, you know, when you tell Republicans, you know, last time, quote-unquote, amnesty happened was under, you know, Ronald Reagan.
1986. They haven't forgiven him for it.
The last time it was proposed was under, you know, George W. Bush. And you tell Democrats, you know, that President Obama, his administration has deported more people, you know, since 1940s or 50s. Bill Clinton, it was under his administration that you have some of these, you know, immigration laws that a lot of people credit to the problem, the current situation. So it's not really, you know, straight down the middle. What's happening at the national level, like Evan, you said this earlier, is that now you have a sort of a Marco Rubio versus Obama after this, you know, White House proposal was leaked.
Quote leaked.
Quote leaked, yeah. The White House said, you know what, we're
so cynical.
The White House said, you know, we're doing what we said we were going to do. We're drafting our own proposal just in case, you know, the Gang of Eight or, you know, these congressional leaders in the House.
But it's crafty because, as has been said, it gives something for the Republicans to oppose. Mm-hmm. They can support Rubio in opposition to Obama, even though 90% or more of what's in Rubio's bill is in Obama's proposal.
Well, hit rewind for a minute. What do they mean by, you know, sort of that, and what do they mean by don't sell out? Is that rhetorical, or is there some issue that where George P. and others
sure
want to hold the ground?
I'm not sure that he was specific in that speech in Addison over what he meant by that.
Did they just want to say, you know, let's propose something and then say, well, we're holding the ground?
Yeah, well, that was my question is what do Republicans have to gain by not, quote-unquote, selling out on immigration? I mean, what is the benefit for them in the party moving forward?
I think they're still trying to figure out at the state level as well what to make of the last election and how to go forward with that. They don't want to just flat out say cave or sell out, you know, quote unquote. But at the same time, they have to be, or they are aware of the fact that this quote unquote sleeping giant that was the Hispanic vote, you know, came out and ushered a lot of people out of office. So it's a balancing act. I can't speak for the Republicans or the Democrats on what they would like to see exactly. I can only say what the differences are right now. And the biggest sticking point is this pathway to citizenship or legalization for the folks that are already here. They say you're going to create more of a problem saying, okay, you get a free pass. So before
you're giving people a place in line ahead of the people who actually obeyed the rules, followed the rules, and were waiting to get in. Now, Ross, the reality is, unlike education, which is really expressly a state issue,
Right. The
fact is, Representative Anchia can talk about, we don't want this to be symbolic, we want it to have teeth. Anything that the state legislature does on immigration is basically symbolic.
Yeah.
Because this is a federal issue. We're going to take our cues.
Unless they get into the issues that they were in last session. You know,
let's
like
talk about voter ID, sanctuary cities, and all
that. Border, you know, increased, you know, police presence on the border, all those drones, all that.
And
kind
at
of
least
stuff.
For now, the Republican Party has not been made to suffer for the way that it has talked about issues affecting the Latino community in the way that the Republican Party has been made to suffer around the country.
Right. Although, you know, Rick Perry might disagree with that. He sort of got whacked for what the state was doing when he went out in the country.
Yeah. But the point is, back home, he's still governor,
right?
And there's no threat to him, no threat to the Republican hegemony, basically, right?
Well, and he's holding his ground. I mean, you know, when you interviewed him as far away as September, he was, you know, what are you going to do about that tuition thing? And he was like, I'm going to do what I've been doing.
By the way, I haven't heard much. We speculated before the session, to all of you, we speculated before the session that in-state tuition might get overturned by this legislature. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard very much about that, actually, since we've gotten into it.
It's, I mean, it's been filed, but I don't think it's...
They got the lid on a lot of stuff that they didn't have the lid on 2 years ago. It's very interesting. Immigration's a leading example of that. But, you know, right. a lot of the stuff that was sort of dominating, particularly early in the last legislative session, right. is gone.
Although, of course, the interesting thing, Julian, and you just wrote a great story about this for the New York Times and the Tribune last week. The interesting thing is that the few Latino Republicans who are in elective office, when they dare to stick their necks out and not follow the script... they get slapped down. Mm-hmm. And I would point to specifically Representative Villalba, about whom you wrote this last weekend, who put a little bit of distance between himself and the party mm-hmm. on the question of expansion of Medicaid, and immediately Michael Quinn Sullivan and his merry band of scorecarders swooped in right. and slapped him on top of his head for it. And so he then has been engaged in this two-week or so argument back and forth about that. And you know, you'd want to think that people could be independent of any kind of party orthodoxy and have their own opinions, but it's occasionally difficult to step out of line.
Sure, and it seems where he came out, you know, very, you know, outspoken about this issue once he got the pushback. I mean, you know, we saw what he tweeted out when the story hit on the New York Times. Like, he's like, it was generally fair, but I'm not a moderate. I'm a Reagan conservative.
Right. You made the point that critics considered Villalba to be a little bit too moderate for the modern Republican Party, and he was very quick. Before 9 o'clock in the morning, he tweeted out, "I am not a moderate. I am a Reagan conservative." Sure. And don't want to let that stuff go unchallenged.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But what is a Reagan conservative in this climate? You know, I mean, what?
And is it possible for a Latino Republican to carry the flag of conservatism as we understand that to mean in this state at this moment, and yet go back home to a heavily Latino district? And be able to win re-election under those circumstances.
It's one of those situations where the, you know, invoking Reagan symbolically, you know, unfortunately for some of those Republicans, also invokes content that they don't like.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a Reagan conservative, except for that thing you did about immigration.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
You
know.
This is a complicated issue.
Right.
But going back to the state versus Fed thing, just one last thing is that, I mean, you're right, it's a federal issue. But what the Supreme Court did last year is they let that one key piece of the Arizona law stay right. which... You know, I had folks tell me before the session came in, specifically former Chairman Solomons, who authored the Sanctuary Cities Bill. He said, look, this is going to give a green light to more of this legislation. I think, honestly, after the Supremes did what they did with Arizona, I think a Sanctuary Cities Bill could be upheld in Texas. But
the question is whether the leadership would have the stomach
yeah,
for
exactly.
that kind of a fight this session.
Sure.
You know,
right.
what has been the message from the leadership is education, water, transportation, mm-hmm. health care. We have too much big stuff on our plate to let these relative side dishes
right.
find room.
Right.
Right. There are probably some people who will object to thinking about sanctuary cities as a side dish. But there it is. So back to the question of entrees here. Let's talk about the budget for a second, Ross, here at the end. Just as we're beginning to get into education in a meaningful way, and just as immigration is on everybody's radar screen, the budget is ever thus. And in the next couple of days, we're going to have the first real test.
Yeah, we got round one on Thursday. We're taping this on Wednesday.
Right.
So.
We're going to see what the response is on the first big mandatory supplemental appropriations bill, mandatory in the sense that this is for the Medicaid money that
right.
we
this
didn't
budget.
This is
the Medicaid IOU. So
we have
right.
to, money we've spent, right?
Well, we haven't spent, but we've budgeted. I mean, we've sort of...
Well, didn't we incur the costs for this for Medicaid in the last biennium, and now we're obligated to go ahead
right.
and,
we appropriated,
and make
we appropriated
good,
the money, and
right.
if our Medicaid program is going to continue starting, you know, on or about April 1st...
This is not an option.
We have to
we
throw
have
the
to
money
this,
into
right,
it.
Yeah.
So this is the bill that has to pass. So if you're Jim Pitts and Tommy Williams, you say, leave this bill alone. It has to pass. Don't mess it up with all this other baggage. Let's get this through clean.
And who's messing it
and
up?
And if you are anybody else who wants something else to pass, say the Democrats, and you want to
right.
put education money back in, you say, that bill has to pass. That's the definition of a good vehicle.
Right. So they
it
think
to
themselves,
pass.
How perfect to be the
right.
fly
so,
at the dinner party on
so
this,
the,
right?
So the House passed a what they call a calendar rule that says basically when this bill comes up for debate, you can't add any more money than you subtract. So the idea here is it's got $4.5 billion for Medicaid, and if you put anything else in it, you have to subtract some of the Medicaid money out of it, right? So that's how the math works. It's a waterbed sort of a thing. But you can have the fight. So this will be round one. There's two other supplemental appropriations bills. The first one is needed but not urgent, and it would cover truly unexpected costs of prison health care and of wildfires around the state, Bastrop and places
the Bastrop
like that.
The fires.
Right, West Texas, all of that
right,
stuff.
Yeah, right.
And then the third one is a bill that is, you know, quote-unquote optional supplemental,
which would, they did a bunch of accounting measures. They sped up some payments, they delayed some payments, they did some stuff. To undo that, in a budget sense, costs money, quote unquote. And that's the third supplemental bill.
And is that, Morgan, the one that we've heard some rumblings about? Iman Bethija of the Tribune reported on last week that there was somewhere just under $1 billion potentially available, and a bipartisan group of House members, five Democrats and five Republicans, are meeting to see if they can restore some of the education cuts from last session.
That's part of it.
That is part of it.
That would be part of, the third supplemental appropriation.
Yes. Right. Yeah.
So really what's going to go on tomorrow is the first round of this budget stuff. And two things to watch are, you know, the content, what actually happens.
Right.
And more importantly, really, this is the first debate, really, on the floor of the House. And so we find out how this House works and how the Democrats work.
How this particular House works.
This particular House works. You know,
right.
We know how the last one worked. It was contentious. The Republicans had the numbers and did what they do when they have those kinds of numbers. They ran over the Democrats. They don't quite have those numbers now. They have
right,
got
but
a lot.
Right, but we have a different dynamic in the sense that we really have three parties in competition
right.
in the House. There's the Democrats. There's the old moderate Republicans. And then
I am not
tea
a moderate.
And then there's the tea, but then there's the Tea Party. And the reality is that the Tea Party guys have the momentum. They have the wind at their backs, and they aren't particularly interested in spending money on anything.
But they also don't have a majority.
And then there's also all the new guys who are kind of trying to figure out where they should land.
Where am I? But I wonder if the Democrats coming at it from the left are mad at the leadership over public education, and they decide they want to screw this up. And not in a qualitative sense, but they just decide they want to not let this pass without causing
right.
some fuss.
Right.
And from the right, the Tea Party guys say, we don't want to spend money. We don't want to spend the money.
And you've got these guys in the middle. You
so
know.
Couldn't the combination of the Democrats numerically and the Tea Party guys numerically actually be more than 76 and freeze something in place?
That's what we're going to find out. We're going to find out, A, if the Democrats want to fight like they did last time or if they want to play along. We're going to find out if the Republicans want to, you know, kind of stick together, or whether this split is going to show up in the first fight in the House. I mean, that's kind of all the stuff we're watching. We're kind of watching how, you know, we all have theories about the politics of this House. Now we're going to actually see what the politics of this House are, and the first manifestation of that is this budget fight.
We just have a couple minutes left. I have to ask about what was maybe the most unexpected thing that happened this week before we go.
Dew drop.
And that is the dew drop in. By dew, we mean Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst. By drop, we mean teardrops. He got emotional this week in defending Bill Powers.
We should say he didn't actually cry.
No, he didn't cry, but he got emotional. Less we can say he got
no
a little
verklempt. Drops.
Yes, I'm not sure that verklempt is in the legislative lexicon. You might want to explain that.
Watch Saturday Night Live.
What language
it's
is
on
that?
Yes, what language? Yeah, do you go to Shul in El Paso growing
yeah, right,
up,
right.
Ross? He got upset, emotional, in defense of Bill Powers, the president of UT, on the floor of the Senate, and started talking about a whisper campaign, an anonymous letter that just full disclosure, we also received that attacked President Powers and his wife personally, or sought to,
right.
that the lieutenant governor implied was somehow being circulated by the president's enemies, whether he meant, as far as it goes, regents.
He didn't say enemies. He implied regents.
It was all quiet on the Powers front for a little while here. And now all of a sudden we're back to Bill Powers at the center of the action. What exactly happened here? Why did the lieutenant governor feel he wanted to get into this?
Well, you know, some of those regents are up for reappointment. The ones that get reappointed are going to be up for Senate confirmation. So it is one way of saying, a pretty efficient way of saying,
right.
hey, governor, the Senate's in this too. We don't like the way this
right.
is going. We don't like the direction of these regents, and we are defending this president. So you're sort of taking sides in this fight.
Maybe more accurately, the three regents who are cycling off in theory from UT, although we expect one of them to be reappointed, are not the big antagonists of President Powers. But there's some concern within the UT alumni community that the people who would be appointed to replace the ones departing would be antagonists of the sort it is perceived were appointed last time.
Right. And Dewhurst just laid down an obstacle.
And so the nominations process would require Senate confirmation of those regents, and so potential new regents, and you think that what he did was basically just throw the gauntlet.
Well, you know, I don't know that it's a litmus test, but if it were a litmus test, it would be, you know, before we confirm you, tell me what you think of Bill Powers. How do you think it's going over there? And he's sort of laid down his own views on that, and I think he would oppose the lieutenant governor on that issue at your peril in those Senate confirmations.
When was the last time that Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst so publicly established his independence from Governor Perry on a significant
matter of policy. It's a really interesting piece of politics. It's been a long time.
In fact, maybe never. I'm not aware of any time. In fact, back in 2003, what I recall is Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst in his first full session as Lieutenant Governor being quite independent in the regular session and less so in the special. And he was criticized during the special as being a little bit more of a lackey for the establishment position on I guess it was redistricting.
Well, this was one
But during this regular session, he was viewed as his own man. And
this
I think
was one of the lines
hard,
in the Cruz-Dewhurst race. You remember how can Cruz attack Dewhurst without also attacking Perry? You know, because Dewhurst and Perry, there's no daylight. So it's interesting.
So him stepping out on his own was actually a quite significant thing.
I think so.
Great. Well, if you want an appointment to the Regents by Governor Perry, there's still time. Or you have any questions or comments about this
This is the Reeve part,
podcast.
Right?
This is the part where I channel Reeve. I'm imagining myself on a folk singer cruise. You are Richard Thompson, and you are one of the Indigo Girls, and I don't know who the hell you
Evan
are.
Evan Smith with a Martin.
If you have any questions or comments about this podcast, we ask you to write us at tribcast@texastribune.org. Hopefully, please God, Reeve will be back in this chair next week, so I can go back to being a part-time as opposed to full-time smartass on this podcast. On behalf of Julian and Morgan and Ross and our producer Todd, and I guess in his absence, Reeve, I'm Evan Smith. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week. Right. We'll save the Amy Winehouse discussion for the drug cast or
something
like that.
Yeah. Great. And now, brought to you by Reefers.
Right.